The mobile home park deals are the best deals that I have ever purchased in my entire career. And they have been the easiest, they have made the most cash flow, and they are the most attractive to lenders, believe it or not. Local banks and credit unions love these. Literally tripled my net worth in 4 months.
Welcome to the Millionaire Journey Podcast. I'm your host, Glenn Yaney. The goal of this podcast is to guide and empower you on your journey towards financial independence.
I have Garrett Terrell here on the podcast today, and I guess, Garrett, if you could just give us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, appreciate you. Thanks for having me on. A little bit about me. So I've been in real estate since 2018, formerly played Division I baseball in college. Basically was an agent and a fix and flip guy for the last 5 years, and really over the last year and a half, kind of started buying and holding more rental properties, and just as of the last 6 months, got into the mobile home park space. So that's kind of the journey.
Awesome. So if you have the, I'm sure there's a long story before all that, but like what, so you Division I baseball, what school was that for?
Incarnate Word University in San Antonio, Texas.
And with that, about how old are you right now?
28.
Okay. Awesome. And so when did you get into real estate? What age?
So I got into real estate when I was 22 years old.
If you could just tell us a little bit about that deal.
About getting
The
in at a
first,
young age.
well, the first real estate deal that you got into, or was it the first property that you purchased?
Oh, so my first deal was a fix and flip deal. So we obviously bought our primary residence right around that time, and lived in it, eventually turned it into a rental. It's a pretty common story out there. But our first actual deal was a fix and flip deal. It was a wholesale deal that I actually bought sight unseen. Extremely risky, but this was in 2018 when the market was extremely good. And it was a insane deal. Still probably one of the best deals I've ever bought and flipped, but bought it at 200. Put 25,000 into it, so we were all in for 230. Listed it on the market 7 weeks later. It took about 6 weeks to do the cosmetic rehab, so it was a very quick fix and flip. Put it on the market for 315. It got multiple offers and sold at 350, and we cleared like $105,000 in 2 months. And that was my first flip in the business, and I was like, man, this is awesome. Let's keep doing this. And yeah, so then did a bunch after that and so on and so forth, but that was our first one.
What kind of financing were you able to get at that time?
Just got hard money, basic hard money. The deal was actually so good. I mean, we were well under 70%. So I work with a really good, and this was in Washington State and moved to Phoenix, Arizona about a year ago. But this, all of these fix and flips were in Washington State. And so basically the deal was so good that it was under 70%. And so the lender that I was working with, a great hard money lender, basically we did a 5% down option, because
Nice.
it was very low risk for them. So I think I literally put like $13,000 down, had the whole rehab funded for me, and then, roughly got $125,000 check. So put down 13, 2 months later, get $125,000 check. It was pretty cool.
So you're like, can we do that again?
Yeah, that was my mentality. I'm like, okay, I can do this. Let's do more of these.
So after that, you ended up with a lump sum of cash. Did you decide now, since I did, I could do one, you're going to do two or three more at the same time, or how did that work?
Yeah, we scaled really fast after that. I mean, we basically start right after that, I posted about it, and so I got a lot of referrals and a lot of traction. Not attraction, but got a lot of traction in my flipping business after that. And, we started doing 2 to 3 flips a month pretty consistently. And really, I was doing that for like 4 years straight and did very well. But, it's just a job. It's really a job at the end of the day. It's not passive income. It's not really creating wealth. You're just basically flipping cash. And there'd be some months where I had to put 150, 200,000 into the market. And then 3 months later, I would get 250 or 300 back. And so it was just a constant churn of, because once that money came in, it was like almost like burning a hole in my pocket. I'm like,
Right.
all right, now I got to go out and buy another one. So it's a drug, in my opinion. The flipping industry is such a drug, but it's also extremely stressful. Nobody talks about this, but
Oh,
it's so stressful. I mean, I could probably talk for an hour about that. But when you have a flip that's on the market and, you know, it's not getting the activity that you need, you know, it's not hitting the ARV that you need. I mean, you can't sleep at night. You can't eat. I mean, it's all you're thinking about all day long. It's just so stressful. And yeah, so I quickly kind of grew out of that phase. But yeah, that's my little two cents about flipping.
4 years quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish I would have bought mobile home parks back then, but I didn't know about it, or at least didn't want to know about it.
Yeah.
We'll just put it that way.
Yeah, my first time I went to my business partner. He was kind of a little bit further along than me, and I bought a 3-unit, and then I bought a 9-unit right afterwards. And I tried to get him to start buying mobile home parks with me, and he was just like, I don't know if that's really what I want to do. And then after I bought the 9-unit, he saw the income. He was like, maybe we should buy some more of these. So
yeah,
with awesome. Flipping homes, my experience has been the idea of flipping a house. And I get so stressed out and so worried before I even get into it that I just become exhausted. I just don't even pull the trigger. And I've actually had like hard money lenders with 90%. And like I look at it now and I'm like, that's a great deal. But then I'm thinking, do I really want to do that to myself? and I could see where the appeal is. Obviously, income is, in my opinion, most important at the beginning. And then afterwards, you can accumulate wealth afterwards. But so when you made that pivot, from what I know about your profile is that you have 60 houses now. How did you get to that 60 houses? And are they all in directly yours, or you have partners? How does that work?
No partners. All me. And my wife. Basically, I just started doing the BRRRR model. You know, I mean, I was so used to, because I was actually a general contractor in Washington. Doesn't mean I know how to swing a hammer or put in flooring or anything like that, but I had such good relationships with my contractors that outsource. I had a very versed knowledge in construction. Let's just put it that way. From doing so many flips and just understanding how the whole process works, the pricing, the materials, like just that whole process, I had an unfair advantage. And so really, I just basically kept doing these flips. I was getting amazing deals. I was buying incredible deals, remodeling them correctly. And basically, instead of selling them and putting them on the market and just hoping the next 30 days that we would get an offer, we just did a cash out refi and held them. And we would do, you know, if it was a little bit tighter, we would do a rate and term. I would leave some cash into the deal. Or if it was a big equity play, you know, we would do a big, you know, 75% cash out and basically pull out the money tax free and then just dump it into the next deal and kind of keep that wheel going of it. But yeah, just basically pivoted and said, you know, I'm not going to sell this. I'm just going to refi it and keep it.
That's awesome. And there's this, so real quick, the first question I had, because this is always the thing that I've ran into, is when you do the BRRRR model, how do you get past the banks on the seasoning of the property? Do you have to hold it for a certain amount of time? Or, I mean, how do you get the value of the property up so quickly when you just bought it?
A great question. And it's still, you know, I don't have the answers for all of these either. These rules are constantly changing. You know, some lenders say they want 12-month seasoning. Some lenders say they want 6 months. Some say they only want 90 days. I've seen the majority of lenders fall into the category of 90 days to 6 months. You know, and there are guys that can actually do no seasoning. You know, they'll charge fees and they'll charge points and stuff like that. But you basically have to find the right lender. You have to build your team. And where I'm at right now, you know, the majority of my time is spent talking with lenders and building the right team of lenders for every single deal that I have. Because really, you're in my opinion, as a fix and flipper or as a buy and hold investor, your backbone of your business is your lenders. It's your refi lenders. Like, oh, yeah. I cannot express that enough. Any hard money guy in the world that can do 90% LTC, 12 to 14%, 2 points. There's a million of those hard money lenders. But the real trick and the real secret sauce to all this is you have to find really good refi lenders. And the majority of those people, and you know, I didn't agree with this in the past, but the majority of those people are going to be local banks and credit unions and portfolio lenders. These national guys, you know, they take your file and they blast it out, and you get these just basic, very basic terms. Oh, we can do 80% and 7.5. And then you actually go through the process, and the next 30 days, your term sheet or your closing disclosure, 2 days or 3 days before closing, looks totally different than what you actually were quoted. And then it changes based on the appraisal and the long-term rental versus the short-term rental on the 1007 on the appraisal. There's all these different factors in there that I really don't like with national guys, because they really can't keep a promise at the end of the day. And it's nothing against them. It's just how that process works. But when you're working with a local portfolio lender, somebody that holds the paper, a local bank, local credit union, there's just so many more advantages as a real estate investor that you have to be looking at that. You know, that's the bottom line.
Yeah. So I was reading on your Twitter profile about its infinite banking concept, but what I was thinking literally last night, this is totally not, I mean, and I sent you the link to that from the Wealthy Accountant.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, I was like, man, if I bought houses, I could totally make my own life insurance policy, not life insurance policy, but the same effect of growing your base with a line of credit. Have you looked into like those first lien line of credits just to have money that flows in and out on a property?
That's hilarious. You're actually the third person to bring that up today.
Yeah.
That I've talked to. Literally the third person. It's too funny. Yeah, you're exactly right. I have actually never done that strategy. I'm still trying to figure it out, because for me to fully grasp something, I have to understand it, like, before I put it into play. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I still don't fully understand how it actually works. I'm a visual guy, so I need to see it. I need to see all of the numbers, but I like the concept, you know, 80% first position HELOCs, and you basically make the same payment as you would to a normal lender, but you're paying down the principal, which is lowering the 30-day interest, you know, the daily interest accrued. So I understand the overall concept, but I need to see like a real life scenario for it. But that's another thing that I'm just now getting into, is the whole life insurance game. Because that's a great way to preserve wealth. And the same thing with the IUL and the 80% first position HELOC. There's tons of these little strategies that I had no idea about for the last 6 years. So I'm just now diving into it.
Yeah. So the way that I kind of came up a little bit was kind of through the home equity line of credit. And what I did, you know, I was super conservative. I was always afraid that the other shoe was going to drop. And I had line of credit on my house. I started with a personal line, and what I would do is I'd take that personal line, pay down my house, and then every dollar I'd get, I'd throw it into the line of credit. And if I ever needed some money, I would pull it out and then recycle over and over. And I was able to buy my house. I got my house payment down to $500 a month because I recasted the mortgage. And then I had a large line of credit after that. I put a $100,000 line of credit, and then I started buying mobile home parks that way. But my monthly payment was $500 a month. So I just thought to myself, there has to be something catastrophically wrong if I can't make a $500 a month payment. So plus I have $100,000 of runway to constantly flow in and out. And for somebody like you with houses, I think it's way easier with mobile home parks. You're not going to be able to get a line of credit on it. So I was thinking maybe I should just look for a house, figure out a way to pay it down, and then create my own little bank thing. And that was kind of like my thought process. And I didn't even know we were going to be talking about house flipping today. I honestly was just like, I saw that I was interviewing today. I was like, and then I thought, man, if I was house flipping, I would look into like maybe a first lien or something like a line of credit. And I think they may do first liens on second, investment properties too, just because they're so safe. Of course, they're not going to lose based on their position on the property. But it's always been an idea that I've wanted to implement, but never got around to.
It's a great strategy. And I know guys that do it. I just personally have not done that strategy. And again, I'm not even 60 days into even learning about any of this. I did all of this the old school, old fashioned way. You know, I didn't do any type of creative stuff for the last 6 years, and I probably should have, but I was just full force, straight ahead, old school, hit the ground running strategy. And it worked, but it's a lot of labor and it's a lot of cash and it's a lot of risk. But there's better ways of doing things, you know, just like in the book that I just read, Becoming Your Own Banker. You know, I'm not sure if you've read that book, but it's an old school concept of basically working smarter and not harder. And that's why I've kind of gotten away from house flipping. And to be honest with you, I don't even like flipping houses anymore. You know, it's a lot of cash, it's a lot of risk, and it's a lot of stress. You know, I would more so rather spend time buying good assets that cash flow from day one and figuring out debt first versus, hey, let's buy it at a deep discount and let's order $30,000 in material and let's deliver it to the house next week. You know, it's just a different way of doing things. But yeah, I'm all about learning these new strategies.
Yeah, it's almost like the set it and forget it method. You like flipping a house is like buy it and then hurry up and get it done.
Yeah, it's not worth the stress, dude. That's just the bottom line at the end of the day. You know, I thought it was going to be life-changing getting those checks, and it is to some extent, but it just makes you have a burning hole in your pocket and you're like, all right, what's the next one? And it's not worth it at the end of the day. I want to sleep like a baby at night. I want to know that I have cash flow coming in, paying our monthly debt and increases over everything else, you know, reserves after everything's been paid for. That's what I want. I don't want to be married to a flip for 3 or 4 months and hope and pray for those 4 months that it turns out well at the end of the day. It's just not worth the stress. And maybe it is for a younger real estate investor who's never gone through that experience, but after going through it for so many years, I can just tell you it's not.
Yeah.
The juice isn't worth the squeeze compared to what else is out there.
Yeah. But it's like with your story, I believe it taught you about processes and volume and then got you the nest egg you're able to accumulate to the next level. I mean, it's just like you flipped houses for 4 years and then I worked at a W-2 that I hated for 9 years. So it was kind of like, I mean, I enjoyed it, but at the same time I stuck it out because it was the thing that was paying the bills. I'm just going to stick with it, roll with it, and then accumulate a nest egg and roll into investment property is what I ended up doing. But go back to the line of credit thing, but it's like one of my favorite topics. For whatever reason, I could watch one video after another to continue. But the one thing I've been seeing, I have a friend that told me he had a $5 million line of credit, and it was my mind was like blown. It's like what I could do with $5 million. I've talked to a few commercial guys and bankers, and they said, yeah, you pretty much have to have the house paid off or the property paid off. And it would be a first lien position. But with these types of rates that are out right now, and I imagine with these short, like what we were talking about, short-term season properties, you might be getting like a higher rate, higher than normal, and a rental property on top of that. I would imagine that this would be the time to be doing that because what I learned is that I was doing that velocity banking thing. And it was when rates were like 3%, which it like such a very small increase in savings. But when you get to that 8 or 9% payments or mortgage rates, then you're able to actually save something. And it's no longer about the monthly payment. It's about just paying down the interest. And then when it comes time that say rates do drop to like 4 or 5% again, you can then pull that money back out and then run it with a fixed rate loan. But it's kind of useless when rates were like 2 or 3%. And I did it for 2 years while rates were low. And I do feel like I had more flexibility because it gave me more of a reserve. But what I would say is that with the rates that there are today, it would be way more beneficial from doing that.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting thing that you brought up. So I actually have a guy here locally who's actually my property manager. Shout out to Steve. He's a beast. But he brought to me this interesting idea of what he's been doing for the last few months or so. But basically, this is probably going to blow your mind because I didn't even know you could do this, but he does the 80% first position lien strategy, right? So he does this strategy, but he works it with the seller. And sometimes he does seller finance with this too. It's interesting how it all works out. But basically, these liens that are in first position, there is a way to structure it to where it is not a first position lien that is secured by the deed of trust. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's another way of doing this. This is where it gets interesting. So basically, whenever there's a loan, it can either get recorded with the county and secured through the deed of trust, right? That is like 99.9% of transactions out there, yes, right? There is another way of doing that. So the second way of doing that is having that note, having that promissory note, lien, whatever, secured by an LLC. Okay. So now when you go to do a refi, so this is what he does. He basically works some of these seller finance deals and has that first position note secured by the LLC, which he can then give cash to the seller and do all that stuff. But then he calls Mr. First Position HELOC at 80% and says, hey, I want to get a first position HELOC. Then they look up the title search on the property and the title is basically owned free and clear.
Yes.
So there's nothing on the property, right?
Yeah.
So then he takes that 80%, right? And he can go out and buy another property free and clear. And there's nothing untitled because he used it at the 80%. So it's kind of like a waterfall method of basically finding a seller finance deal that you can secure that promissory note with an LLC. And there obviously there's a lot of benefits and there's a lot of pros and cons. And you have to work through that with the seller because that's a big hurdle to get over, you know, because most sellers want to be in first position and they want to be secured by the deed of trust. But this is what he's currently doing, is doing that waterfall method. And really, it just takes like one or two sellers to agree to securing with the LLC. And you can essentially just keep buying houses for free. It's a pretty crazy concept, but I've seen it and it works.
Yeah. So we just bought a mobile home park on Friday. It sounds like almost very similar. It was a promissory note secured to the LLC. So we paid. For this one was totally, we paid 15% to the investors, but it's on an LLC promissory note. Yeah. So with that, we pay them 15%. And inside the promissory note, it pretty much says that you can structure however you want, but the way that we do it is that we generally, we're not allowed to pay ourselves until the promissory note is paid off. So we let the property pay for itself. So it's a property that we did have seller finance on, and then we also got the down payment paid for by investors. And I think the overall overhead for the property is, I think it was like $10,000, but it's a property that once we stabilize it, it'll be about $17,000 a month. And it's funny that you say it because we just started doing it probably about 6 months ago. We've bought two or three properties that way where we get somebody to secure, we get people to secure the money towards the LLC. And in the LLC, it pretty much says, like, if we stop paying them, they take control over the LLC who owns the property. So they actually take property over with the, you know, they pretty much have control of the property after that. So,
yeah. So that's basically the same concept. And that deal's in Florida, right? The mobile home park.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
How many units?
That one was 13.
13.
But nice. We did a 20 unit similar to it. We were just starting to learn and we started with 12%, and then we raised 50% of the money, and then we had to bring on some equity investors to invest along the sides, but we ended up having 50% of the equity of the park. But
the 12% is your pref to the investors.
Yes. Yes, including the equity guys, but it was kind of like a last minute scramble. Wow. We were trying to raise 12% and we couldn't do it last minute. And we called one of our guys that funds our deals, you know, and he's like, yeah, show me where to sign.
Wow.
I mean, it was a deal and a half. We bought it for 580,000 and the seller paid 850 the year before. So we bought it.
Wow.
And it was a 20 unit mobile home park with one occupied resident, and every unit was terrible.
Wow.
And we had we're talking about fix and flip. We just pretty much renovate what we could to occupy some, and then the ones that were in really bad shape, we just sell them off. We fix up the outside, so we don't, like, when we sell it, we don't have to like get on the new resident to try to fix up the exterior. We just fix up the outside and then sell it. We might
do
sell
RTO.
It for, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
10 to 12 grand a piece, because the units need about 10 to 12 grand as well. So that these things.
What kind of down payment do you ask for? And what are kind of the rough terms that you sell these trailers for?
Yeah, the minimum is 2,000 down, and it's almost like a rent. And then we try to make it to where the rents are like $1,000 a month. So our goal for that property was to get about 15,000 to 17,000 in revenue monthly. We're still in the middle of it, but we're around 7 or 8 right now. But we'll get to 15 to 17, I think, is what the number will be. It's not, and what we do is we just charge lot rent for those people that do rent to own. So I think the lot rent there is 600, and the rent to own payment was another 400, 500 bucks.
That's great lot rent.
Yeah, because I mean, in Florida, in Tampa, it's well, I hear in Florida, I hear lot rents are higher than most places. But it's funny, like, because in Phoenix, it's Phoenix was like always number one in the market for my old company, and they just their rents were whenever I first started, I talked about this in another podcast, but their rents were 1300 in Phoenix. Their average rents now, whenever I left, which are probably higher now, were like 19, and it was like 2 year of time frame. It went from 13 average rents, and these are all single family homes. It's pretty wild how that market.
I don't even own any MHPs in Arizona. All of my MHPs are in Alabama, actually. So I own a bunch of single families in Phoenix and a little duplex in Washington. That's the only one we held. They're sold off the rest of my single families in Washington because the state's terrible. Don't hold any rental properties there. Bad state for holding. But yeah, I have a bunch in Phoenix, and the rest of my MHPs are in Alabama. And I'll tell you what, I've been loving Alabama. Love the Southeast.
I had one under contract out there, and I don't know what it was, but I just, it was in the middle of rates going from 3% to 7%.
And we were,
but every single deal I look at Alabama, I'm just like, these numbers are so, like, they all make money. Or it seems like that. And there's one law that actually kind of made it a little interesting. They said, if you sell a home to somebody and say they own it outright, it's not a rent to own. If you end up evicting them, you actually have to move the mobile home off the spot and then move it back in, is what I was told the law is, which whether it happens or not is kind of, that was like one thing I was like, that didn't sound good at all.
Never heard of that. That doesn't seem right in my mind.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, they were saying it was like more of like to keep predatory landlords out. So where they were like, they're just trying to take people's houses. It was like, well, if you want to do that, you have to pull the mobile home off and then put it back in after the fact.
Yeah.
And I know that they have certain laws in Florida that they're laws, but I don't know if, I mean, I think that, it's like you have to let the mobile home sit for a certain amount of time before you can even do anything to it and stuff like that.
So on the deal in Alabama, what city was that in?
I feel like that one was Mobile.
Mobile. Okay.
Yeah, we flew into Louisiana and then go into Mobile from there.
How many units was that one?
I think it was 70.
70.
And it was mostly park-owned, and they were terrible. They were terrible units.
Yeah.
Which is what we're used to. We're used to terrible units, but at the same time, we have the crew, you know, in the Tampa market. And then we didn't, it's like, man, we're going to reinvent the wheel when we come out here again. So,
yeah, that's a good chunk. Yeah. So I have 53 pads in Alabama, 33 and then a 20. And they're actually all park owned, surprisingly. And so this is a kind of a debatable topic that I've seen in the mobile home park world. You know, obviously lenders love the tenant-owned lot rent. You know, they love that. But there's another perspective in there that I want to share, because specifically with my deals, you know, the lot rent is about 30%. The market lot rent is about 30% of what our actual park-owned home rent is. But that's not the same in Tampa. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, you can rent a unit there for $1,200, $1,300, $1,400, but you can get $650 or $700 in lot rent. My average rent for my park owned homes is $1,100, but nice. Market lot rent is like $250 or $300. So I understand the overall concept, but I think it's really market dependent, because like for right now, if we did RTO with all of our park owned homes and just charge lot rent, and even if we just had basic seller finance terms on these trailers, I mean, it would not really service the debt. So in our case, you know, we have to do park owned, and these are, you know, these are solid trailers. You know, they're older, but metal roof, fully remodeled, long-term tenants. And we're averaging about $1,100 a month on 53 units. Like, for example, the park that I bought was bought at a 17 cap and it appraised at a 9 cap. Bought it at $1.12 million and appraised at $2.04 million. Incredible deal.
Real quick, what kind of finance did you receive on the Alabama deal?
So I bought it with hard money. Just bought it with hard money, basic. And then the 20 unit bought seller financed. And so pretty much 100% seller financed. So pretty much right now, I'm just going to stabilize both of them. You know, both of those purchases were within the last 3 months or so. So my main park, the 33 unit, actually cash flows like $4,500 a month right now with hard money. It's pretty incredible. So right now I'm just trying to get good long-term debt on it. And I have a few term sheets from a couple local banks and credit unions. I can get a rate and term refi like nothing, but you know, I bought it at 58% LTV. So I want to get, a little bit of cash out. Not a ton, but I'd like to get 70 or 75. And then my 20 unit I bought at 45% LTV. So still looking to do 65 or 70 for that and get some good long-term debt at 30 year, you know, 7.25, 8.25, whatever it ends up being. But yeah, both of those deals will cash flow heavily, fully stabilized with good debt.
Yeah. So I think I've learned a little bit about the value of not having the homes. We have this one refinance that we're working through right now, and it's taken 6 months to get done, but it's a 5-park refinance, and we're in Florida as well. So we're trying to get past the insurance issue. So there's no wind mitigation with Florida. You really can't get anything insured after 1994 or older than 1994. So we pretty much got a bank to sign off that we're not going to have wind insurance. And they end up giving us a rate at 9.25. And I think it was a 30-year rate. They said that we could adjust it 2 times. Like when rates, if say rates do drop, we could lower the rate 2 times in the 5-year term that they gave us. But I can totally see where the value of having, because we went through 50 banks and we found one out of 50 that were able to do it. And there's some things that would change, obviously, if we were to revisit it and go back and do it. But I would say that that was the one big headache with the mobile homes, is to the financing with the banks. And the main thing I would say before you get, just like what you were saying with these banks, these national banks, they'll say, yeah, we'll finance you. And then 5 days before, they're like, yeah, this ain't going to work.
Yep.
So that's just exactly, you know, just let them know if you plan on getting wind, you can. But yeah, if you're deciding not, if you know you're not going to, which is kind of what we told them, we're like, no, we're not going to. It's almost like just disclose it up front, just to not be told no later is what the problem is. So,
and the thing about it is too, is, you know, this is just kind of my overall philosophy of real estate, is there is so much value in control. So, you know, I understand the concept with tenant-owned homes, but there's also a downside to tenant-owned homes. And, you know, some local banks, and, you know, they don't care if it's park-owned, tenant-owned, they don't care. You know, a lot of the national big agency guys, of course they want to see tenant-owned. Yeah. It's in their mind, it's the least risk, right?
Yeah.
But there is a downside to tenant-owned, because once you give up that control they can essentially do whatever they want with the property, and they don't have to remodel it if it needs remodeling, right? They don't have to keep it up to date on the outside. They can leave whatever they want, and they can make it look like crap. And the unfortunate thing is, if they're paying their rent, or they're paying their lot rent, and they're paying their seller finance note, there's nothing you can do about it. So when you have a new tenant coming into the community and they drive by that and they see, oh, this place looks like crap, you know what I mean? And it doesn't have to be every single person, but if you have a 50 pad park and there's 10 or 12 people in there that are not keeping things up, that can really, that can actually lower your rent.
Oh yeah.
In a sense, you know what I mean? And so there, that is the part of the equation that nobody wants to talk about. It's, oh, seller finance everything and get all the lot rent. It's like, okay, but you're also giving up control. And yes, I understand with park owned homes that you are going to have to pay that maintenance and repair. Totally understand that, but you can also run a tighter ship. You have more control of the overall maintenance and repair process. And, you know, and if you implement ratio utility billing or bill back for utilities, there's more ways to capture that overall rent versus then just taking away the maintenance expense and just charging them lot rent and give them a seller finance note. This is something that not too many people talk about, but I think it needs to be shared a little bit more.
Yeah, we have, that's kind of our scenario too. I'm like, look, if we spend 10 grand to make this thing the best, you know, almost brand new, when you go walk inside, it's the 10 grand will get you another, we'll say after all expenses, you're getting back another $600 a year. So it would be more like $6,000 a year. So
yeah,
you're almost getting it back on the first year. And then we've had people that move out, and the cost to turn the property is like almost very little. I mean, there's always something. It's like $2,000 or $3,000 to turn the property back to where it needs to be. But yep, overall, it's a way easier. But when you buy these properties from like rough landlords, that's when the headache comes in. But you can also buy them at deep discounts because most people don't want to deal with it, as in the purchasers.
Yeah. And if you have a great construction background and system and crew, there, if you actually look at the cash on cash return, you know, controlling the deal, charging a higher rent, and paying for a little bit of expenses actually is going to yield a higher cash on cash return versus seller-fying it out to this who knows tenant. And then if they don't pay, it's like good luck trying to get that deal back, because yeah, you don't own it. It's in your park, and they could not do anything for 6 months, and it's going to take that long to get them out.
Yes.
You know, so I've talked about this with the seller that I bought the deal from. And the interesting thing is, she's actually tried the tenant owned aspect before. She's tried the tenant owned park. And from her experience, it does not work. Now, that might be market specific. It might be operationally, you know, there's tons of different variables in there.
Yeah.
But I agree with the overall concept of controlling the deal, even if it means you got to pay the maintenance and repairs.
The other thing from my old company that I used to work at, the main thing about having a good tenant is underwriting. So you got to,
yes,
you have to have qualifying, like a strict, yeah, strict standard. You can't just like get the first person. Because at first it's like you get the first person that walks off the road, or somebody, if literally somebody reads your sign off the road, probably a bad tenant. You know, you're not like, this guy's, yeah, walking down this busy street and he sees a house for rent. I don't know if this is exactly the good quality resident that I want moving in.
No. And some guys, I mean, from what I've heard, some guys, they would seller finance that deal to that tenant.
Oh, they buy them all the time.
Then they wouldn't hear back for 4 months, and they're, you know, they got a $3,000 balance, and good luck trying to get that back. That's all, yeah, I got to say. If you control it, you know, you can get them out immediately, and you can bring in a new tenant, and you can charge a higher rent, and you can set the standard for the park. So here's my thing. I'm going to be park owned until I get proved wrong otherwise. I just inherently believe in park owned. Now, a 100 unit park, that's park owned, that's a little bit different. But some of these smaller deals where you can kind of control everything, You know, I'm gonna stick with Parkown until I get proved otherwise. That's my opinion on it. It's probably not the opinion of a lot of people out there, but that's just my opinion, and I'm gonna stick with it.
So I talked to one guy. He has a ton of experience with mobile home parks. He like kind of taught me. I had one guy that taught me a lot, and then this guy told me like taught me the institutional way. And the guy that taught me the institutional way, he was also a broker in mobile homes, and he was super sharp. But he told me, I said, what's the magic number of like park owned and unit count? Like, cause you can tell like what you're saying is like, when you get to 100 units, you're probably not going to, you want tenant owned at that point. But he said, when it gets to around 50, because if you have 50 park owned homes, the value is going to be way more on a park owned home park compared to a tenant owned, because they're looking at cap rates. But so like if you buy like a 10 unit mobile home park, which is what we have one, to sell them all off, we did sell a few off because they're in such bad shape that it was like, there's not even worth fixing, but we would sell some of them off, but we try to keep as much as possible because really the end buyer is going to look at the total revenue of the park. And I learned that through trying to sell, I have a 3 unit and a 9 unit, and I try to sell both of those. And everybody always asks, are they park owned homes? And they would have paid me way more for my park if it was a park-owned home. They didn't even care. Yeah. Like, but they're all, this one I bought from a guy that had 1,400 units. And he said he converted all of his parks to tenant-owned. And they were going for under $50,000 a pad is really the short story. But if you buy, if you look at tenant-owned or park-owned in Florida, they're going for 60 to up to, I mean, I've seen them go up to $100,000 a pad.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter like what the expense ratio is or anything to a certain size. So when you get to that 50 plus, then it turns into bank financing is really tough, all this stuff that goes with it. I don't know what it's like in Alabama, but Florida, it's just, you know, people hear Florida mobile homes are like, there's a hurricane coming to knock them all out. So.
Oh yeah. Insurance. Yeah. That's all I've been hearing the last year is the insurance there is terrible, but you got, you know, double the lot rent of what I can get in Alabama. So it's all relative. But it also, I think it depends too on the play that you want to make. You know, if you want to go the institutional route and buy these 300, 400, 500 unit parks and get agency debt for them, of course you want tenant owned, you know, because that's the industry. But then you're bringing in partners, you know, and you're getting a 5 to 10 to 15% of 300 units. Okay, that's still great. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you want to own 100% and you want to control the deal and kind of create your own economy and keep it lean and mean, you know, that's another philosophy that I have is, you know, sometimes too many chefs in the kitchen is not a good thing. Sometimes if you keep it lean and mean, you know, trim the fat, and it creates a much better quality of life, in my opinion. For my parts, they're ran so efficiently. And, you know, I have very good communication with my management company. We do weekly reports. It's really run very, very well. And it's been a major blessing for us. But it just all depends on what your goals are. Because I personally, I like that kind of niche of, you know, 20 to 50 units. You know, I would prefer to just keep stacking those, buying them with hard money, buying them with private money, buying them seller finance, value adding, and then refining with local banks and credit unions. I'm not sure if you've ever worked with local banks and credit unions before, but it's so much easier than working with these national guys. They're just like, oh yeah, you want what? You want what? Okay, when do you want to close? Okay, let's do it. It's so much easier.
Do you own your parks? You don't have any partners?
No.
So I think that is also another thing to notate, because when you do have, when you're by yourself, they're looking at you as a individual, and
sponsors. So you're talking about
as you as the individual, as in Garrett is a one man show, and really there's less downside because there's no bickering, there's no like disagreements with partners. It's Garrett by himself. But what I would say is that we bought this park, the 20 unit out in Auburndale. It had one tenant, and he went through a bank and got financing, $850,000. And he got a, it was like a construction, he had an earn out on it. So what he pretty much did is said, he told the bank he's going to do all this stuff. He has this whole project laid out of what he was going to do to this mobile home park. And he was going to get another $500,000 once he was done with the project. So he was trying to do this from California. And this park was the kind of park you have to be hands-on. It was such a bad park. So anyways, I mean, we still go there once a week just to see, like, make sure that whatever's not happening.
Yeah.
So anyways, but this guy was able to go through a conventional bank to do this financing on a park that only has one tenant on an $850,000 loan. And that's when I learned then is kind of how important it is to have a good balance sheet and build up your balance sheet. And yep. When you have obviously more on your balance sheet, the bank's willing to give you more money. And that's kind of like what it sounds like with your story. And with us, that's how we got into the story with the 12% guys, where they're attached to the LLC. We're like, look, we need to have more ownership, or else we're just going to have somebody else co-sign with us for everything. You know, we bring on a partner, and the partner will be getting more of the GP status, and that's kind of what it turns into.
Yeah, if that's the play that you're making, then people can do that. People can bring on a partner. People can bring on a sponsor. That's the play. But if you don't want, too many chefs in the kitchen, again, I'm going to use that analogy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it's not always the best thing. Sometimes, like for me, I've learned over the years to be very, very careful with how I pick my partners.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I trust myself at the end of the day, but I mean, even just on a little single family deal here in Phoenix, partnership kind of got a little weird and he breached and had to remove it from the LLC. Kind of a little bit of drama. But again, it just proves my point as to, and I understand control. I think there's a lot of value in control. For example, my father-in-law was a CFO for Kelp Senior Communities, one of the largest senior assisted living companies in the United States. They own like 4,500 units, all new construction, giant company, right?
Yeah.
Their CEO does not bring on any partners.
Wow.
They have their private money. Or, they're investors that invest into the deal, right? And they get paid a return or a pref, but he doesn't bring on any partners. He does everything himself, right? And, these are 30, 40, 100, $200 million loans, and I've learned kind of from this, there's value in control of the deal. Regardless of people's opinions, there's value in that. And so, if it gets to a point where I see a 300 pad park that I need to bring in a sponsor for or something like that, because I'm not going to take down something like that all by myself, definitely going to bring in a partner or two for that. But again, that's not the play that I want to make right now.
Yeah.
If it gets to that point in the future, yeah, I'll do it. But I really like the niche of 20 to 50 unit.
Mm-hmm.
Either distressed sellers or value add sellers, and then buying with private money or seller finance and refining with a local bank. I am totally fine with stacking deals like that.
Yeah.
And I don't have to report to anybody else. I can get great debt. It's one personal financial statement. It's, a couple folders, sending out to these lenders. And I don't really want to put more work on my plate than I have to, right? Because that's also what I've learned in the flipping business is, you can do a bunch of flips. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to net a lot of money. So that's when I started kind of focusing towards buying the right flips, doing one flip, having one headache over a 2 or 3 month period. That's going to net me 3 or 4 times the amount of buying 2 or 3 that are just okay deals. I would rather do one incredible deal over 3 months than 3 okay deals in 3 months and net the same amount of money. Because it's time, and I value time and mental peace or clarity or whatever you want to call it.
Sleep.
Sleep. Yeah, less stress. Like, what, we're doing this to not have more stress on our plate. So why would I want to bring in 8 partners on a deal and get 1% and, get a $1,400 check or, whatever? Why would I want to do that? Just to what, say that I owned 300 units or 500 units or whatever. I don't care about that. I'd rather own 100% and keep stacking deals like that.
Yep.
And really cash flow every single month. Cash flow $7,500 on a part. Yep. Instead of just the bigger unit play. Because that's all just, in my opinion, that's all just ego. I mean, if you're looking for buying 500 units and having a 1% sliver of that, just so you can say, you know, I own 500 units. Dude, that's not paying the bills every month. That's ego. You know what I mean? That's my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I think income is most important. And if the, you know, whatever you can get, the best use of your time is really what it comes down to.
Time is so valuable. I got another quick question. How are you sourcing your deals right now?
Brokers mainly. We're kind of known as the guys that buy those smaller parks, kind of like what you're talking about. We buy, you know, we'll buy a 10 unit, but we'll buy up to, I mean, we want to buy 100 unit, but we want to buy between that 20 to 50 unit count.
Yep.
We'll buy parks that most people won't buy. It's just, they're parks that are unfinanceable. We have a great first hard money lender pretty much, but he holds the note for 3 years and we have to get it figured out by then. And we've gotten it down a lot faster. Like the park that I keep bringing up, the 20 unit, that one's going to be stabilized within, I mean, we closed in, I want to say September, and we should have it stabilized. Like we'll say the end of February, well, everything will be done. So I mean, it used to take us like a year and a half to get that done. And we have all the people available and we have 3 construction crews going at all times. So it obviously brings credibility. Yeah.
How many units are you up to right now?
We closed the end of the year with 2 more places. So we're at, I want to say we're at 251.
Wow.
Like you were saying, we have partners. And we've learned how to structure deals to where everybody benefits, but at the same time, we've learned to not do small deals with partners because just like what you're saying, it's like nobody really makes any money on the small deals unless you own the whole thing. And it's like a park that's like this 10-unit park that we have. It was a $300,000 park that pays $9,000 a month, you know? So it's like we raised $400,000, but to work with the banks, you have to have everybody under 20%. So we say we raise 200 first lien and then 200 as equity. That 200, you can only put in, it's like $40,000. So you're raising a bunch of partners and then you can't refinance out of it without those partners having to be signers on the mortgage. So at that point, we've learned that we can buy smaller stuff. It's just got to be structured differently. And if there is a partner that wants to be an equity partner, they'd have to be a signer on the mortgage because you can't get around the, you can, I think I've been told that there is way you have to register the property a certain way, but generally the banks want to see who's over 20% on every mortgage or on every ownership. And that's why we took a 5-unit portfolio and we put them all together. And that's how we did it. Because if there was a bunch of guys that were putting in like 100, 200 grand each. And those guys would have been like 50% owners on some of the deals. And they would have been signers, which they would have never signed. So we would have had to sell the properties. But these things are so hard to find that we just wanted to hold on to them forever is really the short story.
So why haven't you guys bought some of these deals with hard money, right? Or private money or whatever.
Yeah.
Get a first position lien at hard money. And then why don't you raise the cash to close in second position and keep it cleaner that way?
We started doing, that's what we did this past Friday.
Okay.
We had one deal that fell through and then we pretty much were able to take those investors and the deal was right down the street and these guys had already committed. So we didn't want to tell them, hey, we don't have the deal anymore. So we already had a deal open. So we just pretty much moved their money and they were equity investors. So it's a great deal. But then the other deal was a mobile home park. And that's why we had to pretty much raise the second lien pretty much. But yeah, we've learned with the smaller stuff.
You'd prefer to do it the cleaner way though. You wouldn't prefer to bring in, you know, 10 people at $40,000 each, I'm assuming, right?
Somebody told me this a long time ago and I've learned it slowly, but equity is the most expensive debt that you'll have on the property. So it's
yeah,
whoever's the equity on the property will be the most expensive debt.
Yeah.
There are certain investors that really just like a fixed payment.
Yeah.
You know, I still have partners on that property that we just bought in Thonon Sassa, but the way it is that it's a structure that, like, say for me, I actually did put a good amount of money down on that one. Even though we put no money down, I put myself as a second lien on it, but it was 15%. So I'm like, I'll take 15% all day. And I'm still, you know, I'm an equity, I'm one third equity, but I wanted to get paid along the way. I don't want to just manage a property and not get paid. So that's why I took a handful, you know, I had some cash. I just sold my house. So I rolled that equity from my house into this deal and, you know, increased my income by $3,000 a month, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. So you like that play a little bit better of giving these people, because obviously you have a certain pref with some of your private money investors. Are you giving your private money investors any type of equity on the back end if they're also getting a pref?
Yeah. So if we were to buy like a larger deal, like a $2 million deal or a million, we'll say $1 million deal even. And we usually have like two options. It would be like one would be equity, which would be 8% and then plus upside. And then there's another one that's generally either, it's either 8 or 9% or 12%. And we'll pay the 12% would be like the secured to the LLC debt. And the 8% would be secured to the partnership, as in like they're a direct owner, they get a K-1. And with the promissory notes, they're getting 1099. So it's like an interest payment to them.
Yeah, that's good. But again, but you're raising that whole entire $1 million, right?
Yeah, so
you're
we'll not... get like a private money guy that funds like 60 to 70%. Then we'll raise the remaining 30 to 40% plus the renovation cost.
Okay. So you'll have the private money guys in first position.
Yeah.
Right. But you're saying these private money investors, it will all be basically grouped together in a second position.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Well, it would actually...
But there's a lot of people in there for that second
lien. Yeah. Yep. I mean, yeah, there's... That's why I always say the income's most important. So like there's guys that invest with us. Like I'm thinking of one guy. He makes a lot of money a month. Like he can buy these deals on his own, but he doesn't have the time to find them, you know? So it's more along the lines of we're finding these deals and then we're including him in and then we get paid along the way. But like, so if you have income and you're able to, like, that's why the house flipping thing is, I'm sure you know who he is, Ryan Pineda. And he always talks about getting to $250,000 a year income before you even buy into any rental properties. Because the $250,000 a year is when you actually start having money to save and put towards a rental property and build wealth. But he's like, up to that point, you're just barely getting by. And I completely agree with that. And that's kind of my thought as well. And, so it's not a crime to make a lot of money.
And no, not at all.
Then you can roll it into these deals. And I believe that's how you did it. You got yourself to a sustainable, good income, and then you were able to roll into wealth building assets.
Well, see, the funny thing is that's what people think, but I have used more cash in my single family deals than I have used in my mobile home park deals. That mobile home park deal that I bought for 1.12, I literally brought less than 20,000 cash to close on that.
Nice, nice.
No partners, no nothing. Same thing with the 20 unit deal. My cash to close was like 11,000 or 12,000. So I haven't used any of my own cash. I've used other people's money. Well, so those two deals is not other people's money. The single family deals that I've done, you know, the rentals that I have here in Phoenix, I would bring in a first position hard money guy at 90%. And I would bring in private money in the second position, usually one person. And I have like a list of like 10 people right now that are legit private money lenders that have told me they want to lend on deals. And I've only used about 4 of them so far. So basically I need more deals, but they will be in a second position and they will fund the cash to close for the hard money. They'll put the 10% down and then also the rehab budget. And so that will be a very clean first position, very clean second position, and then I refi them out after that.
Yeah.
So that's basically how I get it structured now. But previously, I used to use my own cash for these flips. I would put the 10% down, my own cash, and we would hope to God that it's under 70% of the ARV so we could get the rehab funded out of the hard money. But anything on top of that, you know, if it was, you know, a deal where we had to be in for 70%, but there was, you know, some countertops that we had to do or some landscaping or whatever, and it went up to 72 or 75%, I didn't have any private money lenders at the time. I had to use my own cash. So that's what I did for years and years and years. And I thought I was so smart by doing that, but it's not. The reality is to be an operator and to also bring in your own cash is so dumb because you're not really getting paid for your time or your risk or your knowledge. So really over the last 2 years since I started buying and holding, you know, I've brought in other people's money and it's been awesome. They love it. They love the weekly updates and the 2 week updates and the pictures and the, you know, social media stuff. They love that stuff because they don't have to do anything and they just sit back and collect money. So yeah, that's kind of how I've structured it with the single family. But to be honest with you, I am probably going to lean away from single family. Just my mentality is I just, you know, when you're doing these single family deals, you can be in the deal for 3 or 4 months, right? Mm-hmm. 3 or 4 months is a long time. You know, it's a third of the year. Basically. And so at the end of that 3 years, or sorry, the end of that 3 months or 4 months, best case scenario, if it's an Airbnb, you're going to cash flow $1,200 a month or $1,500 a month or so. Mm-hmm. So it's like, man, you're really trading a fourth of the year for $1,500 cash flow. It's like, are you sure that's what you want to do? You know? And I didn't understand this in the past because I was like, man, that's great income. What are you talking about? But after doing this mobile home park deal, that cash flow is $4,500 a month with hard money over a 3 month period. I'm like, okay, I'm making three times the amount of income with this mobile home park in a 3 to 4 month period of buying and closing and everything than I am with a single family deal. Why the hell would I ever do another single family deal again?
Yeah. Yep. I and feel so the same way it's about just, single family.
I do not like single family.
I understand it's the most understandable one, but at the same time, it is by far, it's very expensive and it's low leverage is really what it is. So
low leverage. I mean, I've done over 200 single family transactions and I have done 2 mobile home park transactions. And I'll tell you what, the mobile home park deals were the best deal. Obviously, they had to be the right deals for all of
this.
You can't just buy anything and it just makes a ton of money. It has to be phase 1, phase 2 underwriting, all that jazz. But just overall concepts, the mobile home park deals are the best deals that I have ever purchased in my entire career. And they have been the easiest. They have made the most cash flow and they're the most attractive to lenders, believe it or not. Local banks and credit unions love these, want to keep them on their balance sheets. And fourth, it's literally tripled my net worth in 3 months, 4 months. I was hovering little under $1 million basically for the last 4 years just because we had so many. The PFS was always changing because we had these, oh, I have these 2 flips this month, but not the next month. You know, it was always changing, always hovering like right around that like 800, 900 range. After I bought these 2 mobile home parks, it bumped up to 3.2 million on personal financial statement.
Nice.
And so I'm like, okay, I'm onto something here. Because first of all, I love the cash flow. Like cash flow pays for the lifestyle. I'm totally a Grant Cardone believer in that. Like cash flow is the holy grail for everything.
Yep.
But if you're buying these deals right, it increases your balance sheet and increases your PFS so much. Yep. And you are attractive to these lenders. You know, there's a different type of respect that they give you as soon as you send them your PFS compared to if you have nothing on the PFS versus a couple million to talk about. It's just a different conversation. So, dude, I'm all into mobile home parks. You know, some people are self-storage guys. Some people are multifamily guys, you know, stabilized, you know, B-class, that whole jazz. Some people are RV and boat. I think you and I probably both agree on this.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know what it is, but I just love mobile home parks.
Yeah.
It's just, it like just pulls me to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just understand it. for some reason, I don't understand self-storage.
It's hard.
Okay. I get multifamily, but it's extremely risky and it's kind of like flipping. And we're talking six caps, seven caps. But dude, I just understand mobile home parks. I don't know why, but it just makes sense in my brain. Do you feel like that?
Yeah. So I feel like once you get the system down, it becomes where it's like, why would you do anything else? I'm in that camp. Cause there's this one guy I was thinking is this one guy I know super successful. He has like 600 houses and he told me he's lost money buying multifamily, but this guy knows something I don't, because he's killing it. And I'm like, this guy, I mean, I can't judge somebody by their materials, but they have very nice things, gigantic house, but he has a system for everything. So I would say if you have a system and he flips 200 houses a month, he has 600 houses owned clear and free and clear, no debt on 600 houses. I'm just, you know, he's got it down. But I would say that my wheelhouse is mobile homes. And we can figure out the thing about apartments is that we have the crew that I can tell you we can stabilize an apartment within 2 months compared to a mobile home park that takes, because we usually buy them very distressed. Like they're usually on the market for a while before we buy them and nobody wants them. And it's like the email I was just telling you about, it was like, this park's been on the market for a long time, and like over 6 months. I've seen it forever, and then I think we might actually strike a deal, you know. But it's like one of those things that the reason why people can take lower offers from us is that we are experienced, and they can see we have a website and all that stuff that shows that we're able to knock down deals and take care of them. That's why they're able to seller finance them as well. And somebody like yourself, you have your website, and it's like a brochure of yourself, you know. So it's a great way to, I guess, conduct business. But with mobile homes, it's all about scalability. And if you can do that, and I would say the other thing, I know I've already told you, but having and you've already said it, the personal financial statements straightened out and having that ready, it's easier to access the mobile home world, because a lot of, it's a hard to enter finance place when you're not getting 3% down financing from a mobile home park, you know, so.
No, and I've never seen a higher cash on cash return than mobile homes, like, period. Bottom line.
Yeah.
Like some of our mobile homes, I mean, my seller was telling me, because the 20 unit is about a half mile away from the park that I have. And 10 years ago, 15 years ago, she was buying these trailers for $10,000 cash and putting $2,000 into the remodel. And they were renting for $600, $700 a month.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that is crazy. Yeah. Obviously, there's operations and there's a little bit of expenses and there's utilities, and I understand all that. But I've never seen a higher cash on cash return than mobile homes.
Yep.
Like it is across the board, across any asset class, it is the highest cash on cash that you're probably going to find in the industry. Now, it's all not about cash on cash. You know that, and I know that. But it's a great starting point, because cash flow solves a lot of problems.
Yes.
Solves a ton. It is the holy grail, right? It's what we're all after. But yeah, having this on the PFS, and, you know, just have, like, right now I just have a little folder on my iPad of like PFS, T12, rent roll, OM, survey, appraisal. It's just like a package of like 10 things. And I just blast it out to some of the lenders that I'm talking with. And it's just so easy. They click the Google Drive, they read through the whole entire thing, send me a term sheet, you know? And so it's like, these systems are, I'm learning these systems, but I'm quickly realizing that, man, national banks do not like mobile home parks as an asset class, just as in general. They want to see apartments. They want the Grant Cardone, Fannie Mae, Freddie deals. They want those deals. Local banks and credit unions want these mobile home parks. It's because of the yield.
Yeah. And they do charge higher interest, but you're able to pay for it through the higher income, of course.
Yeah. And it's the ease and convenience of it too. Do you want to be talking to some dude for 60 days, or, you know, do you want to be two or three phone calls and close in 30?
Yeah.
You know, speed and convenience. I've heard this. I'll leave it with this last thing. I've heard this in the flipping industry. And basically, this is my philosophy in mobile home parks. There's two things here. If it's not a hell yes, it's a hell no. That's the first philosophy. Second is price, speed, and convenience. And you have to pick two. That's a really, really good quote that I heard from, gosh, I think it was Brent Daniels.
Say that one more time.
So it's price, speed, and convenience. And you have to pick two. That is with lenders. That is with sellers. That's a seller quote that you can give them. It covers a lot of different categories. But in my opinion, in our world, that really boils down to talking with sellers and talking with lenders. Because I don't know about you, but the majority of my time is spent doing those two things. Yeah. Talking with sellers and talking with lenders, you know, or, you know, private money, whatever.
Yep.
Those three can technically qualify. But same thing with a bank. Price, speed, and convenience. So in my opinion, I would take speed and convenience. That's a local bank, right? Price and speed, you know, I mean, we're talking Fannie debt, Freddie debt.
More scrutiny.
But it's not going to be convenient. Not going to be convenient. They're going to look through everything. And so I'm like, man, that is such a good quote. I need to get that tattooed on my forehead or something. Because it's just so true. Price, speed, and convenience. Pick two. That comes up with talking with sellers. You know, hey, do you want a cash offer? You're going to have to give up price because it's going to be speed and convenience. Or seller finance. If you need your price, it's going to take a little bit more time. It's just a great philosophy. Those are my two philosophies that I would give to people out there trying to get into the flipping business or trying to get into the buy and hold business. If it's not a hell yes, it's a hell no. And then the three, price, speed, and convenience, pick two. If you do that, if you just do those two things, you're going to be so much farther ahead. And you're not going to have to go through all these headaches and all these hiccups over the last 5 years. That's my biggest piece of advice.
Awesome. Where can people find you?
People can find me on Instagram at Garrett_Terrell. You can also go to my website, GarrettTerrell.com. Also on Facebook and recently as of Twitter, where I connected with you. Awesome. And I'm loving the Twitter space, by the way. So connect with us on Twitter. You get to see kind of into the back end of our minds and how we think about things and different strategies. So I'm loving Twitter.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll put all of his contact information in the show notes. And thanks for being on the show.
All right. No problem. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Millionaire Journey podcast. Please rate, like, subscribe, leave a comment, and share with somebody you'd think would benefit from listening. Till then, see you next week.